comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right.
So, hey, everybody. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web on kpfk.org. We're also part of our website, www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. And you can tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks, and I would love to get tweets during the show that I'll read. On August 29th, which is very, very soon, is somehow the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And today's show is part of essentially a three-part set of events. The first today, I'm going to focus on my book, Katrina's Legacy, White Racism, and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, and do a lot of thinking about the 10th anniversary of Katrina. The second is next week. We're very excited and very much appreciate the support from KPFK Pacifica and our program director, Alan Minsky, because we're going to have a two-hour special next week, focusing primarily on an appreciation of the life of the late Julian Bond, who died only a week ago at 75 years old. Julian was, of course, one of the leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, helped to form the Southern Poverty Law Center, was a leader of the NAACP, an anti-war leader, and it's very upsetting. A little more than a year ago, I went to Jackson, Mississippi, on the 50th anniversary of what was called Freedom Summer, or the Mississippi Freedom Project. At that 50th anniversary, again, thanks to Alan Minsky, my program director, and I went with Julian Lamb and Catherine Murphy and William Sabourin. We went to Jackson to both celebrate and just to join in the reunion of the 50th anniversary. I also did a series of interview conversations with some of the leaders of the 1964 movement. One of them was with Julian Bond, very impressive human being, and we had a wonderful conversation that many of you heard at the time in Bright played on KPFK on June 2014. It was hard to grasp that Julian died and that I was going over the interview conversation with Julian Lamb, who works with me at the Strategy Center. Julian was one of the people who went down to Mississippi. And it certainly played incredibly well. I've also transcribed it into a written interview, which is going to be published this week in Counterpunch magazine and hopefully in others, but Counterpunch being very important. So next Tuesday, we have a two-hour special focusing primarily on an appreciation of the amazing life of Julian Bond. From 4 to 6. Voices is on every Tuesday at 4. And again, thanks to Alan, we have the entire 4 to 6 period. I really hope that you listen. And then the next Thursday, which is September 3rd, at 5 o'clock at the Southern California Library, and Julian, if you would text me the actual address, but it's on Gage and Vermont in South LA, that there's going to be an evening pretty much with me sitting around and talking. We're going to talk about Julian Bond. We're going to talk about the 50th anniversary of the Watts Rebellion. We're going to talk about the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And I'm going to do some thinking and talking about where I see today's civil rights and black liberation movement going and the need for a real multiracial movement to defend the rights of black people, obviously led by black people, but we need every single person in the United States to deal with this. There's a book I have, I'm not going to read it to you, but there's a book called The Non-Jewish Jew and Other Essays by Isaac Deutscher. Really good book. It's about Jews like myself who basically rejected Judaism as a philosophy, but were just nonetheless Jews who both suffered anti-Semitism, and in many ways were influenced positively by our Jewish experience as opposed to the Jewish religion. And there was a line in the book that's very scary because it basically says that the Holocaust and the genocide against the Jews was received with not much outrage at the time it happened. And shortly thereafter, when everybody did find out that 6 million Jews were killed, and I want to point out that everyone knew 6 million Jews were killed. I do not buy the story that, oh my God, only until the Soviets and the United States came to Germany did everybody realize about the death camps. That's ridiculous. But the point was that that genocide took place in front of the eyes of Christian and non-Jewish Europeans, and the vast majority of them either supported it or were hardly outraged, and were hardly outraged when they found out. One example being that most of the Nazis were either rehabilitated into West Germany or were rehabilitated into the United States as scientists for the Cold War. The reason I raise this, not that it's not valid on its own terms, is we're presently in the midst of another genocide, and that is a genocide against black people in the United States. And the word genocide is either used in the perception that it's hyperbole, or it's used in a way where people go, yeah, okay, it's genocide, but we don't grasp the full extent of what that word means. So in my 10th anniversary of Katrina and the 9th anniversary of my book, Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, I'm working on a new version of that book, and it's called Katrina's Legacy, The Black Nation, The Black Latino Alliance, The Indigenous Peoples Movement, The Third Reconstruction, in alliance with the nations of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, confront the U.S. imperialist white settler state and its climate crimes. Every one of those statements, that do I believe there's a black nation? Yes, I do. Do I think the Black Latino Alliance is critical? Yes, I do. I think that Indigenous Peoples Movement is critical because it's essentially the original sin, as Hillary Clinton talked about, although I think she was talking about slavery, or maybe she was talking about her and Bill Clinton, I'm not sure. But whatever it was, then the question is the Third Reconstruction, which is a concept of a political movement needed in the United States, the alliance with the nations of Africa, Asia, and Latin America confronting, and what does that mean, the U.S. imperialist, do we believe the United States is imperialist, white settler state, do we believe the United States is a white settler state? Yes, I do. Please see Bernie Sanders, who's a senator from a white settler state, an all-white state, virtually Vermont, confront the U.S. imperialist white settler state and its climate crimes. On the 10th anniversary of Katrina, I want to talk today about a particular element of that genocide, which is the climate crime that was carried out against the people of New Orleans, and that is still operative today. So here's what the show is going to be about. First, I'm going to read a draft of some of my thoughts about what does it mean to say a genocidal climate crime in relation to Katrina 10 years later. But as you know, on Voices from the Frontlines, we don't primarily focus on the problem, we focus on the solution and people doing it. So the second part of the show is going to be, or the second part of the conversation is going to be about the right of return. And I'm going to be reading from the work of some groups in New Orleans who are presently doing some excellent, excellent work. In particular, a group called Communities Rising, and Andisha Jouarkhali and Bill Quigley, who I've been talking to and talking a lot about their work and the work they're doing on Survivors Village Tent City activities that are happening now, that are happening right now in New Orleans in preparation for the 10th anniversary. So if you can follow where I'm going, I'm going to talk a lot about climate crimes and why I believe that there has been a climate crime that took place, a genocidal climate crime in New Orleans. Then I'm going to talk about the right of return, because the key element of the crime is that 100,000 black people have been driven out of New Orleans. They have the right to return, but there is very little movement to demand their right to return. And then finally, I am going to go to the phones and mainly take phone calls from Barbalat Holland, Manuel Criollo, Julian Lamb, and Channing Martinez at the Strategy Center, who have been working with me on this, to get some of their comments, because I've been working in preparation for the show for about 4 hours today and weeks and weeks and weeks. Okay, so you're going to bear with me? You get it. This is about the 10th anniversary of Katrina, and we're going to deal with what about a genocidal climate crime. So I want to read to you from some stuff I've been working on. Katrina's legacy, the Black Nation, Black Latino Alliance, Indigenous Peoples Movement, the Third Reconstruction, nations of Africa, Asia, and Latin America confront the U.S. imperialist white settler state as genocidal climate crimes, is an historical intervention on the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, an international cry for help to stop U.S. genocide against the Black Nation, a call for the effective right of return of 150,000 Black people driven by the U.S. government from New Orleans, and a deepening conversation about climate change, imperialism, and the concept of genocidal climate crimes and what we can do to end them. It begins with a real-life event of such enormous magnitude that's almost impossible to grasp its scope and the revolutionary imperatives to reverse its outcome. A story unto itself that demands telling and retelling, but also an essay on revolutionary strategy that does not require the reader to agree as much to engage, debate, take action on any of the demands I and the movement are proposing that require the moral imperative to act. Because one thing that's really important is I do believe there's a Black Nation. I do believe the United States is imperialist. I do believe it's a climate crime. But for you, listeners, the most important thing is, do you agree that there are 100,000 Black people who have been driven out of New Orleans? And do you agree that you have a moral obligation to work to fight for their right of return? So the short story of Katrina and its legacy is that on August 29th, 2005, a Category 5 hurricane off the Gulf Coast came crashing onto the shores of New Orleans. Had it taken place tens of thousands of years ago, before there was human habitation on the planet, and what is now called the Americas, it would have come and gone with no significant damage or impact, just part of the natural cycles of water, wind, and land. But in 2005, Katrina was both a human-made catastrophe in the severity of its ferocity, the direct impact on the people involved, and in what we call and still should call white racist America, an attack on Black people, the people of the Black Belt South, and the Black Nation, a climate disaster multiplied exponentially by a racist system looking time and time again to inflict suffering on Black people, to break the back of any hope for Black power and Black resistance, and one of the great forced migrations of a subject people in the 20th century and the 21st century. The driving of 150,000 Black people out of New Orleans and the permanent reduction in New Orleans' Black population from the beginning into 10 years later of 100,000 people. Now let me explain the different numbers. Apparently 150,000 real people were driven out of New Orleans. 50,000 Black people have come back to New Orleans, but the actual people were not the ones who left. That is to say, there are 100,000 at least Black people all over the United States, in Houston, in Dallas, in Los Angeles, in Shreveport, in God knows where, who have been driven out of New Orleans and can't get back. They can't get back because they have no jobs. They can't get back because their apartment is still destroyed in the lower Ninth Ward. So imagine, listeners to KPFK, 100,000 Black people are missing, and very frankly, this country doesn't give a damn. So why is it a climate crime? First, the actual impact of the storm itself was multiplied by the greater heat of the ocean water due to global warming, a direct impact of fossil fuel-driven greenhouse gases that heat the air, which in turn heat the water. Did you know that 90% of all climate change is reflected in the temperature of the oceans? That increased heat generates strong and more volatile storms, that's what's called extreme weather events, from only the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, that's to say in the 1750s, 1850s, 1800s, 1850s, which is code for the greater exploitation of land, labor, and resources by Christian imperialist nations, and a genocidal use of indigenous African Asian labor. It led to first the destruction of 10 million people in the transatlantic slave trade, and now a society based on the exploitation of labor, women, nations, and nature, by a sick system. So when you hear about, you know, when you were a kid and you say, oh, the Industrial Revolution was great because it brought a lot of technology, which a lot of people are all fascinated with now. But we don't understand that the so-called Industrial Revolution was only a quantitative or in sometimes qualitative increase in the exploitation of labor and the genocidal exploitation of labor, including getting rid of people altogether, so-called labor-saving device, except that labor is working people. So as such, the first human causation of Hurricane Katrina was the wanton generation of fossil fuel-driven energy by imperialism that in turn warms the water, that in turn generates more powerful hurricanes. The second human-made and racist element of the crisis was the spatial and racial design of New Orleans. How many of you have ever been to New Orleans and know what we're talking about, the Lower Ninth Ward? The Lower Ninth Ward was understood to be a more dangerous neighborhood, not because of its people, but because of its vulnerability to flooding and damage. Well, no one could have imagined the profound damage of Hurricane Katrina. Obviously, white, wealthy people could imagine it well enough to choose not to live there. And low-income black folks understood its dangers well enough to know they were living there because of the relatively lower rents, precisely because the Lower Ninth Ward was lower, in ways they wish it wasn't. Again, the geography of New Orleans is not set by capitalism, but by the relative risks of inhabitants. No coincidence, as we say, that the Lower Ninth Ward was truly devastated by the flooding and was understood to have that vulnerability before Katrina, as hurricanes were no stranger to New Orleans and vice versa. Now, I went back and read an article I wrote in about 2006 in World Watch magazine. I wrote, the most flood-vulnerable area of the city, the Lower Ninth Ward, was 98% black. Other neighborhoods below sea level include Eastern Orleans, though more than 80% black, the lowlands of Mid-City, Bywater, and Gentilly, all with high percentages of black residents. Even in the central city area, whites lived on land above sea level. The Garden District was 89% white, Audubon was 86% white, Touro 74% white, and the French Quarter 90% white. People in New Orleans know that the race and class distinctions in the city correspond to the sea levels of the residents. Poorest are forced to endure the risks of life below sea level because that's where the most affordable housing is. The third human cause, that is the U.S. imperialist cause of the crisis, was the levee system. Now, listeners out there, when you imagine what happened in Katrina, do you imagine that it was a flood and that it was a Category 5 hurricane and that the flood is what just washed all over the people and destroyed the city? Interestingly, and I thought that too, that wasn't completely the case, because what happened was, yes, the flood was terrible and people were killed, but the biggest issue is that the levee system, the dam system, that was supposed to dam system in both ways, that was supposed to hold the city together, didn't. The levees broke, and that was a significant factor in the driving out of all the black people, the destruction of the Lower Ninth Ward, and so forth. So I wrote, one of the forms of the decline of U.S. society as a whole is its contempt for its own cities, cities being black and Latino, but also its own bridges, its roads, its tunnels, the so-called infrastructure. As the United States reverts to barbarism, it can't even invest in its own built environment with all its class and race privileges already built in. Geologists, urban planners, just sane people have been warning the U.S. and New Orleans officials that the levee system that was built to restrain ocean flooding, because New Orleans land had such precarious relationship to water, would not survive a major flooding such as produced by a Category 5 or any other level of major hurricane. So again, as I wrote in World Watch, Dr. Ray Seed, the chief of a team of scientists from the University of California in Berkeley that assessed the recent levee repairs, said that the overall New Orleans flood protection system must be considered suspect. People died because mistakes were made and because safety was exchanged for efficiency and reduced cost. In the Netherlands, where the population lives on average more than 2 meters below sea level, that's, looked it up on Google, 6.5 feet, journalist John McQuaid observed in New Orleans Times-Picayune that Holland is a nation whose flood protection makes New Orleans look primitive and slapdash. Urban areas of the country that is in Holland, such as The Hague and Rotterdam, are engineered to withstand the kind of storm surge that comes only once in 10,000 years. And he talks about how much money they spent in Holland. But there's one problem. The Dutch are protecting white people. They're protecting themselves. The Dutch, who created genocide in Indonesia, did you know that the South African Boers were Dutch? So the Dutch are a very racist people, another group of white Europeans. They didn't do anything to protect the people in their colonies. But yes, they invest a ton of money to protect themselves, which are mainly white Europeans. My point being is that black people in New Orleans could have been protected, but that would assume that the government cared about a city at the time that was 500,000 people, about 66% of whom were black. So the fourth human-caused, imperialist cause of the climate crisis was the actual death and suffering caused by the hurricane. Listeners, how many people do you think died during the actual hurricane in New Orleans? The answer is 1,836 people died. I don't know why everybody agrees to the person on this number. But also, 705 additional people are missing. So we're talking about 2,500 people died. Yes, about 70% or more of whom were black. The fifth human-caused abuse was the destruction of the homes of the residents of New Orleans. Today, the Lower Ninth Ward is still a disaster. It has not been rebuilt. And people, I don't know if you know, but in New Orleans, people have lived there, black people have lived there before slavery. There are families that have lived in, black families that have lived in New Orleans five, six, seven generations who had their homes destroyed because of Hurricane Katrina. And 10 years later, the Lower Ninth Ward has not been rebuilt. Before I finish the new version of Katrina's legacy 10 years later. Of course, I plan to go back to New Orleans and do a walking tour of a lot of the work that's being done there and also the work that's not being done by capitalism. But again, remember, which I'm going to get to, when I go back to New Orleans, there's 100,000 less black people than before Katrina. But the fifth, and here's my main point about the climate crime. Even, and I don't mean even to belittle it, even after 2,500 people were killed, you know that the United States government could have come in, made a major, major investment in bringing everybody back, could have rebuilt it. You know, during the Northridge earthquake, which was overwhelmingly white, FEMA came in with a lot of money and gave people grants, and of course then gave construction companies grants, gave mainly white people. I'm sure they gave people of all races. But the point being is that there were very, very few black people during that earthquake. And FEMA can come in with lots of money. FEMA can rebuild people's homes. But they didn't do that in New Orleans. But here's the terrible thing. Just the opposite happened. The United States brought in military troops not to help black people get back to New Orleans, but rather to keep black people out. Now, we're going to talk about how did 100,000 people get driven out of New Orleans and sadly never come back. And then I'm going to talk about the work of Community Rising. I wanted several of the people to be on the show today, but they're busy. They're all busy working on preparation, of course, for the 10th anniversary events on August 29th, which is, I believe, this Saturday. So I just wanted to read you something. I read it. I think it's called The New Internationalist. I want to give them credit. I read an excellent article that laid out some of the abuses of why people in New Orleans were both left to suffer, but also how they were kept out. For instance, during the crisis, it said some 1,400 firefighters from all over the country headed to the Gulf Coast to help, but they were corralled by FEMA and sent to Atlanta for public relations training. They were told that their job would be to shuffle around the region passing out flyers telling people to call 1-800-621-FEMA. Some peeled off their FEMA-issued T-shirts in disgust. They got People Hero Search and Rescue certified, paramedics, hazmat certified, complained a Texas firefighter. One team of 50 firemen did make it to New Orleans, though. Their assignment to stand by President Bush for photo ops as he toured devastated areas. The American Ambulance Association offered to provide 300 emergency vehicles, but the General Services Administration and FEMA turned them down. I want to talk about the international aid. Hundreds of doctors and nurses from far and wide have attempted to aid stricken New Orleans residents, only be turned away by the U.S. government. Among those stopped from carrying out their life-saving missions by FEMA. 113-bed state-of-the-art mobile hospital with 100 surgeons and paramedics, which drove in a convoy for 30 hours from North Carolina, and a large medical team from Georgia with 31 doctors, nurses, and paramedics, were turned away by FEMA people with guns. Now, I also want to talk to you about why socialism is such an important system for black people and why capitalism failed them. International offers of aid have been routinely ignored or rebuffed by the U.S. government. This was in 2005. Cuba, the world's most advanced country when it comes to hurricane response, has offered to send over 1,000 of its highly trained and respected doctors, 1,000, each equipped with a specially developed 50-pound hurricane relief pack. The State Department refused the offer and then lied that it was never made. The U.S. also refused Venezuela's offers of gasoline, heating oil, and doctors. Of course, Venezuela being, at the time, led by President Hugo Chavez and still being a socialist country or moving in the direction. And Sweden's offer of thousands of working cell phones so refugees in shelters could contact relatives and friends was also denied. Now, I could go on. I think you've heard the stories, but we're talking still about, for instance, buses that were taking people out of New Orleans were passed by Shreveport and weren't allowed to stop and had to take people all the way to Atlanta. People were taken to Houston, where they went from into the Astrodome after having left the Superdome, and which Barbara Bush said, well, these people have never had it so good. They have meals. So why didn't they get back? Why are 100,000 people not back? Well, first of all, they destroy their homes. The second thing is there are no jobs. The third thing is that the government, in order to take a group of people that were dispersed, and I like the word refugees. I know that there's debate about should black people be called refugees. It's up to them. But in some ways, they were driven out by their own country, and they're not allowed to come back. The sad thing is, trust me, they're not living in a big duplex in Atlanta or Houston. To this day, they may be homeless out on the street. They may be sleeping in a family garage. They may be working for $6 an hour in a minimum wage job. So now let's talk about what people are doing about it. I want to thank Professor Bill Quigley, who's been very helpful to me in giving me leads on people. And I want to talk to you about a group called Communities Rising. This is Eric Manuel on Voices from the Frontlines. And in terms of our new guests, Manuel Criollo, Barbara Lott Holland, Chani Martinez, and Julian Lamb, I hope you would start calling in to the station 818-985-5735. One of you will be on in about 6 minutes. So here are the demands, which is happening now, not 10 years ago. The goal of the 10 cities protest is not to commemorate what happened in 2005, but to fight the ongoing injustice against the poor black residents of New Orleans and to build a movement for the right of return for the 100,000 black New Orleans citizens who are forcibly moved from their homes, excluded from the efforts to repopulate the city. In their names, we make the following demands. Number one, this is great, the creation of a road home program for renters in which the city will use excess FEMA and other funds designated for poor people to locate New Orleans citizens around the country and give them assistance in returning home, including travel and rental costs, security deposits, and other needs they may have. Two, live up to its promise that prior residents will have priority in the new developments that have been built on public housing land post-Katrina. Recent reports show that prior residents make up as low as 7% of the populations of new mixed-zone developments. Ensure the promise to allow every resident of Iberville to return home will be enforced once it is finished being developed. Residents are being reported tremendous difficulties in qualifying to return to their homes in Iberville while the area becomes wider and wider. Four, the Housing Authority of New Orleans should not sell any of the former scattered site property to private developers and should instead use this land to develop affordable housing for poor people. Five, any property that was designated for mixed income use and is not developed should be used to build affordable housing for poor people. The missing 100,000 black New Orleanians are our family, loved ones, friends, and neighbors. We're preparing for a protracted struggle for their right to come home. The new New Orleans is not our New Orleans. Housing is a human right. Bring the people home. What's exciting about this is that at the Strategy Center, we focus a lot on what we call demand development. And these are some really, really great demands that people have given a lot of attention to. I want you to write to communitiesrising@gmail.com, communitiesrising@gmail.com, and say, how can I help? I heard this on Voices from the Frontlines in L.A. or nationally. communitiesrising@gmail.com. I want to help. So now the following. Comrades, I've always understood there's never an absence of movement. If the progressive forces are dormant, the forces of regression will be on the move. The forces of great wealth and white supremacy were much more prepared for what happened August 25, 2005 than we were. They also had the government at every level, city, state, and national, in their corner. We've taken a pretty brutal beating over the last 10 years, but we're still standing. I look at the coming week not as a time to commemorate or celebrate or dedicate, but a time to plan, bond, and rededicate ourselves to take the soul of our city. Hey, that's funny. Fight for the soul of the cities. People all over the country are talking about retaking the soul of the cities, relating it to demands. Survivors Village Tent City Activities. There's a final planning meeting Wednesday, August 26th, which I believe is tomorrow, at the Fight Back Center. Preparation and Banner Party, Thursday, August 27th. Anyone progressive banners or tents we can borrow, please let us know. Friday, August 28th, the event will officially start at 6. Teach-in after the opening ceremony by the Chicago Anti-Eviction League, Solidarity. Saturday, August 29th, participation in a march from the Levee Breach to Hunter's Field, a teach-in by Cooperation Jackson from 6 to 8. Sunday, August 30th, direct action protest around the city, targets to be announced. Teach-in by James Williams on the work going on in Seattle, and a separate session by Bill Quigley and M. Indesha Jukali on the history of the public housing struggle in New Orleans, showing the importance of history. So, this will be followed by a celebration of homecoming by the residents of public housing. So the point is that the struggle is going on. There is a right of return vigil. New Orleans is right now smaller, whiter, and more affluent, and they're fighting up to stop it. M. Indesha Jukali, Bill Quigley, thank you so much. So fans and listeners, listen carefully. It means so much if you do something. The first thing is please send an email to communitiesrising@gmail.com and CC me, Eric, at voicesfromthefrontlines.com. I want you to send an email to communitiesrising in New Orleans at gmail.com and say, I support the right of 100,000 black people to return. I want to help. I listen to you on Voices from the Frontlines. What can I do to help? Send a copy to me, Eric, at Voices from the Frontlines, and I will follow up and make sure we can do everything to help, okay? And if you can, tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks so I know that you're out there. So I want to start, if it's okay, with Manuel Criollo and thoughts about this conversation, thoughts about what's on your mind. And Manuel Criollo is the director of organizing at the Labor Community Strategy Center, who's been helping me a lot in trying to gather my own thoughts, both for the show. And just one more thing, Manuel. Next Tuesday, again, from 4 to 6 on this station, kpfk.org, will be a two-hour special of Voices from the Frontlines, primarily about the life and contribution of Julian Bond. There'll also be some brief conversations about the 50th anniversary of the Watts Rebellion, which we'll have in a subsequent show, and another follow-up about the 10th anniversary of New Orleans. How you doing, Manuel?
Hello.
Manuel Criollo, how you doing?
Good, yourself?
Okay, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that you're saying that is very important and that I think it's very cognizant of what's happening now with the rise of the black community sort of in revolt against much of the national oppression that they face is the concept of, you know, there is four crimes that the UN recognizes, right? One is genocide, the other one's war crimes, the other one's crimes against humanities, and the other one is crimes of aggression. All of them are interrelated. Obviously, some of them come in flashpoints or in rapidness, but one idea that I've been playing a lot around is the idea of ecocide, which I know some people are actually trying to make it as another aspect of those four forms of UN sort of related forms of aggression. often define as the extensive damage to the destruction or the loss of an ecosystem of a given territory. And I think this idea that in reality this is an actual climate crime, I guess, both puts it in the hands of the U.S. and puts it on the hands of those corporations that the U.S. state tries to cover for. And I guess, to me, that's sort of been the symbolism of what has played out in New Orleans. But in some ways, we have to really look at Katrina as sort of a center point of how to understand even the current moment of resistance that we see in the streets.
Well, one thing I think is good is that I wrote to my friend Bill Quigley in New Orleans, and I said that, am I wrong? Because I'm not getting a sense that the fight over the right of return, and as you're saying, you know, in terms of making demands on the U.S. government about the return of the 100,000 people, and he said, you're right, that the mainstream has already written this off, but that the groups in New Orleans are making these demands. So I think that, you know, one of the groups we know is called the Alliance for Environmental Human Rights, mm-hmm. and Monique Hardin. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're saying, Manuel, is they have been doing work around the United Nations, obviously. They've been using a human rights frame. So I think the question of ecocide and writing to them and saying, are you using ecocide as a concept? Because people are still going back to the United Nations to make these kind of demands. So I just think it's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
I have a woman named Joanne in Santa Monica. She says she's writing an article about the topic. Joanne, I'd like to have you on the show.
Hi, thank you. Listen, the thing that I find so fascinating, I was researching this Katrina and the 201 reaction. And in October, after 9/11, the U.S. Congress allocated $7 billion to be distributed to the surviving family members of the victims of the towers. Now, this is really interesting. It was done immediately. That's taxpayer money, okay? That was our money that was donated. And it wasn't donated in an equal basis. It wasn't divided into the 2,800 victims and their families. It was divided according to a value given by Feingold, I think his name was, who was the distributor appointed, who was paid about $1 million. And there were amounts given in $245,000 to low-level persons who were deemed low-level, not unequal citizens, up to $7 million, depending upon the income you were earning. So in other words, the richer and the greater your salary as a financier or a trader or whatever, the more you got. Now, why do I bring this up? Because it should have been done immediately for the people of Katrina. And I'm just, you know, it just stunned me as I was reading this, why it wasn't done. And then I realize I have the quote from the congressman from Baton Rouge who commented to the press, nature, God has done what we couldn't.
Thanks very much. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the point I'm making and the point you're making is that a climate crime first starts as an ecological disaster that was in itself caused by humans.
But they knew.
Susan, I think it's great, and I'm going to move to somebody else. I'm responding to your point that a climate crime starts as an ecological problem, but then imperialism responds to it as a political problem. So if they want to validate the lives of the people who died in the September 11th crisis, they give a high cash value. If they want to keep 100,000 black people out, they do it through the role of armed force. And the reason why I think this is important is imagine as the ecological crisis gets worse and as there's more floods and there's more hurricanes, the United States is going to send in allegedly human disaster teams into third world countries, except that they're not going to leave. What I'm getting to is the United States uses armed forces in this case to keep 100,000 people out. And in the other cases, as you pointed out, it uses it to benefit people. Channing Martinez, what do you have to say?
Eric, first of all, thank you for Katrina's Legacy and hosting this show. I think it's very important to a lot of black folks, including myself. I think one thing that I'm seeing, which you sort of loosely alluded to, is that a lot of what needs to be mentioned about Katrina is the images of catastrophe of black people. And I think the reason why I want to mention that is because with the movement for black lives and a lot of the work that a lot of black folks are doing around the country, including ourselves, right, one thing that we are seeing is that it's almost as if they are presenting public lynchings of black people, right? So we see the black people suffering from Katrina. We saw a whole movies about black people being pushed into these big, gigantic gyms, even though, as you mentioned, there was resources coming from all over around the world to help out black people, because the reality is the rest of the world realizes that the commitment that black folks made with the civil rights movement all over the world, right? And so that's one thing I do want to point out. The other thing is, speaking about the UN, United Nations, because I do believe that we do have to use the United Nations as a force, but my question is, how do we get the United Nations to actually react and take action on some of the things that they are passing? So, for example, if they're saying that it is wrong for the United States to kill people, kill black people via police, then my question is, how are they able to enforce that, to actually do something about it, instead of simply just making a statement?
Well, several things. Thanks, Channing, and there's some static. I don't know if it's in my head or in yours, but I'm going to respond to what you're saying. Maybe hang up so I can... I think the thing that's very important is there's a book called The Darker Nations by Vijay Prashad. I've read it. There are certain books I read over and over and over again, both because it's hard for me to fully grasp everything, but also because they're very pivotal. Channing's question is, you know, this whole issue of taking things to the United Nations. There's a book I'm reading called We Charge Genocide, which was written by, well, it's a statement that was drafted by a black communist lawyer in 1951, James L. Patterson, signed by W.E.B. Du Bois, another black communist, signed by Paul Robeson, another black communist supporter, signed by many other black people who were very close to the Communist Party and very close to the Third World Communist Movement. And they brought charges against the United States based on genocide. Those charges were not accepted by the United Nations because the United Nations is dominated by the United States. So the United Nations refused to accept the documents. But the struggle to get the United Nations to accept those documents was critical. And all over the world, for instance, people could have a rally and say, we demand that the United Nations accept the charges against the United States. My point, Channing, and other people listening, is that whether or not we get an institution to do exactly what we want doesn't mean that we can't have a political victory. The Palestinians have consistently had resolutions passed in the General Assembly of the United Nations, which were vetoed by the Security Council through the United States. But that doesn't mean that they were not important politically in isolating Israel and a vote of no confidence in Israeli policy. So the main thing I am saying and the main thing I'm learning and the reason I'm focusing on genocidal climate crimes is because, like Manuel was saying, using terms like ecocide, using terms like genocide, you don't use them for the heck of it, means that you're arguing that the government in which you are operating is violating your rights to such a degree that if you believe you're an oppressed black nation, you have certain human rights as a subject people, as the Jews were in Germany, to call on the international community for help. And I think that if black people in the United States start going back to the United Nations, making charges, if the young people in Ferguson, if after things happen with Eric Garner, if after things happen with Michael Brown, if people are saying, I want to take these demands, I believe it's genocide, I want to make demands on the United States, I want to make demands on the police, but I also want to go to the United Nations, President Obama, because I believe the laws of the United States do not protect me. The laws of the United States do not protect me against genocide. In fact, the laws of the United States enforce genocide. This is the direction that a movement could really play an important role. And we at the Strategy Center are in the early stages of not just studying about it, but trying to think about how could high school students in Los Angeles both make demands on their own school board, but also make demands and bring those cases to the United Nations. So, ladies and gentlemen, I was just told by G that I got to go. So a couple of things. Next Tuesday, 4 to 6, we're going to focus on the life of Julian Bond, who sadly died just a few days ago. Then also, next Thursday, September 3rd, at 5 o'clock, at the Southern California Library for Social Science Research, and I'll get you the address, but it's basically on Vermont Engage. Please come out for that evening. I'm going to be talking about Katrina's legacy. I'll be talking about Julian Bond. And we're going to have a whole discussion about where's the black movement going and where are people of all races going to do to stand up to support black people in this time of crisis. Eric Mann, I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines. I really want to thank Channing Martinez, my producer. I want to thank G. I want to thank Manuel Criollo. And I want to say that on August 29th, besides the anniversary of Katrina, is also the birthday of my grandson. Take good care of yourself. Thanks, Raider.